Progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to you, lurking conservatives. I didn't get a full scream out of that. There it was. It sort of came in halfway. That's okay, Chris. I could tell when I walked in, buddy. I could tell when I walked in that my buddy Kalo DePresto had a rough night. Not sure why, but we'll get into it later. We don't have to get into it right away. Mark Riley, of course, out for the week, taking a vacation, fueling up for his big resurgence in a couple of weeks on his own show here on Air America Radio from 5 to 7 in the morning, followed by Rachel Maddow out from 7 to 9 in the morning. We're in, I think, the 12th count. 12th day countdown here. This is the 12th to the last morning sedition show. Thank you again for all the emails and support. Appreciate it. Just got this yesterday. Mark, I am sorry to hear morning sedition will be changing. You guys are one of the first places to give critical Iraq vets a voice. I wish you the best in your newest endeavors. Please stay in touch. That's from Paul Rykoff from Operation Truth, the executive director. Been on our show a few times. It's very nice to hear from people. Today, what is today? Today is World AIDS Day, my friends. World AIDS Day. That's a big day that the world must continue to raise awareness that AIDS still exists. Still exists, and it's growing. There have been 3 million deaths in the past year of AIDS. There have been 5 million new infections this year. Infection rates are rising in nearly every part of the world. We may be losing the war on AIDS, people. Education is a huge initiative. Proper protection and making people understand they need to protect themselves is hugely important. But the scary thing is over 90% of the people that are HIV positive in this world do not know their HIV status. It's astounding, but understandable. It is scary to get tested. It is easier to live in denial on some level. It is a deadly path for you and everyone you have sex with. There have been education campaigns and campaigns to try to get medicine to those who have no access. Of course, these campaigns need much more funding, but there have never been really great campaigns in terms of internationally, in terms of sub-Saharan Africa, which is the worst affected region in the world, where 95% of the total number of people with HIV worldwide live, to get people tested. And it's really pretty easy now. You know, they have saliva tests that take like 20 minutes. But the bottom line is 12,000 people will get infected today. 90% of them will not know they are sick until around 2013. And just from a personal point of view, I mean, I'm 42? Am I 42 already? I'm 42, you guys. 42. How the hell did that happen? My eyes are going. I can't even see right. This is the worst thing. I have to get, you know, I got a prescription for progressive lenses. You know what those are? Those are like, it's a nice way of saying bifocal. All right, without this bifocal, without the line, it's just a hazy little boundary there. All of a sudden, you're like, "Hey, I can see far," and if I just look down, there's no bifocal, there's no cut in the glass, but I can read down here. So you don't look uncool with the cut in the glass. How did I get from AIDS to this? Selfishness. But what I was going to say is, 42 years old, 1981, when the first AIDS case appeared in the newspapers, I had just started college, had no impact on me whatsoever. I'm not gay, I didn't have many gay friends, and even people in the gay community didn't snap into, you know, recognition of what was going on until a little bit after that. But by the time I was 2 years into college, everyone I know, including myself, was so frightened of AIDS, we thought that you could get it everywhere. And, you know, I remember the first couple of times that I got tested. It's a horrendously scary thing. But I know a lot of people, even now, I know people who, and it wasn't even that I was having particularly risky sex, but at that time, everybody was frightened of getting AIDS. Chris, were you frightened at some point? Did you get tested? Of course you did, right?
Yes. Yes, I got tested, and I actually, on my college newspaper, I actually posted the results of the results. I actually got a mouth swab.
Oh, so see, they didn't have mouth swabs when I was coming up.
Oh, really?
When I was coming up.
What would you have to do? Like a blood test?
Yeah, you had to go get your blood test, and they had, you know, some places you had to wait like 2 or 3 weeks. But the issue is
that I had to wait a week.
You had to wait a week. Well, they have all these new tests now, and I know why people are afraid to get tested, because if you, it resonates in your head that either you're going to be stigmatized, either you've done something wrong, either it's going to affect your employment, either you're going to die, you're going to have to tell your friend or lover or girlfriend or boyfriend.
Or multiple partners, like everyone partners in your past.
So the weight of it was just insane, you know. And I knew that there was a real good chance I didn't have it, but I would get obsessed, and you would go in, and then you'd sit there with that slideshow. Maybe it was her. Maybe it was her. You know, hey, how'd he get in there? But the issue is, That people are afraid to get tested everywhere. And there has been some progress, I guess, in Africa in terms of companies. Even the De Beers Diamond Company has put into motion a awareness campaign that people, encouraging people to get tested. But even here, I talked to Larry Kramer not too long ago, that there is a resurgence of AIDS in the same way that I was talking to Brendan McDonald before the show, that the generation after me really sees younger kids now see AIDS as really an international problem that affects mostly people in different countries in Africa. It doesn't resonate with them immediately. And just like, where was I going with that? I was just going somewhere with that. But the bottom line is, come on, man, wake up, Maron. Don't lose the train of thought.
Hey, you know, actually, when I got my HIV test, the doctor, you know, sat me down and he's like, yeah, just wanted to know it's negative. I'm like, wait. That's not bad news. That's good news.
Right. Negative is the, yes, is
negative
the one you want.
Is good, and positive is bad.
I remember what I was saying, that there's a new generation of gay men who are in their 20s or in their late teens who see AIDS as being an older gay man's disease. And with the use of crystal meth being so popular in that community, the idea of condoms and the idea of safe sex gets really pushed aside. And there has been a slight elevation in cases in the younger gay community, which I know concerned Larry Kramer a lot, because there are men in that community and women in that community that have fought so long and hard to raise awareness, to change people's sexual habits, to get condoms, you know, integrated into the culture in a way that even if you don't use them, you probably have one. I never knew about condoms coming out of high school, but once AIDS hit, that's the one thing it did. I think that people, by and large, have safer sex now. Unfortunately, the people in the United States, approximately 1.2 million people currently live with HIV in North America. Since 1981, more than 1.5 million people in the U.S. have been infected with HIV, including more than 500,000 who have already died. New HIV cases are down from its peak of more than 150,000 per year in the 80s to approximately 40,000 new infections per year today. That's incredible progress. Racial, and that is all because of education, and all because of people who have fought long and hard to get people aware of how to protect themselves and how to raise awareness of this disease. Treatment could still be getting out there in a more effective way, that's for sure, and drugs should be made available to anybody who needs them, because the drugs are very effective now, and they're more effective than they ever have been. Certainly there are people that might be actually not having HIV in their bloodstream after using these drugs, or living prolonged periods. I've known a couple of people that have been going on 15, 20 years on these meds. You know, 15 years, I think. I don't want to push it. But 15 years still going on the new medications.
And Magic Johnson, how about him?
Yeah, well, that's another thing, is that he changed the culture, too, in terms of scaring people and raising awareness. And he's still alive, and apparently he has no sign of HIV in his bloodstream. That's like
amazing.
A miracle. It's a miracle. But today is international. It is World AIDS Day. You know, put on your ribbons if you want to, you know, make people know that it's still out there. You know, donate money to wherever you need to donate money to make it feel like you're doing part of it, and try to, you know, have safe sex. Until you're really settled in with somebody and you've both been tested several times, and then, you know, have a party. It's 14 past the hour. It's Air America Radio. I'll be talking momentarily about, it seems to me that Samuel Alito, the new nominee for a Supreme Court, despite the fact that he's been running around, you know, kissing senators behind, trying to make himself look like the type of guy who wouldn't be a judicial activist, that wouldn't legislate from the bench, that wouldn't let his personality and opinions interfere with his judicial responsibilities. But you know what, folks? There's really something to be nervous about, and we'll get into that in a second. It's 15 past. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning.
Morning Sedition. Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it. Eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Nineteen past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out for the week, resting up. Later in the show, Tim Robbins is going to pop by, see what's going on with Tim, talk about the death penalty a little bit. Right now, though, you know, when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews Wi-Fi Trendline Translator, the 5000 model. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All righty. Yeah. From the Los Angeles Times, Bush, Iraqi forces in state of readiness. Bush, Iraqi forces in state of readiness. Translation, Iraqi forces no longer run when cars backfire. From the Associated Press, possible miniature solar system discovered. Possible miniature solar system discovered. Translation, Japan builds smaller, more fuel-efficient solar system. Because, you know, they build the cars that are so good that people get mad at me for liking.
They're very short, so everything has to be compact.
Wow, okay. Well, I'll have to look at the numbers on that. I'm going to let you sit in your racist statement this morning, McDonald.
I don't think that's racist.
You think? Oh, you think it's just reasonable that they're short?
It's not reasonable. It's just a fact. It's a genetic thing. And I actually remember one time that there was a concerted effort behind the fact that that compactness was what made everything more efficient.
This guy, this old cat in Boston, used to do a joke. DJ Hazard used to do a joke about Japanese tourists taking pictures of everything because they were building a scale replica of the world back in Japan. That's kind of funny. All right. From Reuters. It's a weird day today already. From Reuters. Study: longer hypodermic needles needed for fatter buttocks. Normal. What is this study? Longer hypodermic needles needed for fatter buttocks. Translation, doctors push longer and harder for new hypodermics. See, there was a fat joke in the selection of things.
Yeah, buttocks was going towards that.
Yeah, I know. There was one there, but my heart reaches out to fat people.
Why is that?
Because I can't, you know, I have an inner fat person. Why would you say that I'm one of them? Why would you say that I'm one of them?
Because you're always commenting about how
Yeah, but that has no bearing on reality. What would lead you to say that I'm fat?
I don't know, maybe the fact that you say that I'm fat every day?
That's an interesting segue into what we're going to be talking about, how language affects perception, Chris, because clearly I'm not fat, right?
Yes, you're very skinny.
But I have an inner fat person
believes
in
him. We'll get your mom on the
phone. No!
No! Marshmallow?
Oh, you know what I did? I screwed up Marshmallow. That's right. Come on, Marshmallow. Oh, now you've hurt me. Now I'm a crying little boy inside. My father's birthday was yesterday. Boy, did I screw up. Happy birthday, Dad, if you still love me. Hey, look, so moving into the speech that our president made, I will talk about Samuel Alito in a few minutes, but Bush, in front of a fixed house, obviously, at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, tried to resell a tired, stay-the-course agenda to the American people, an American population that, my friends, a recent Gallup poll found 63% of those surveyed disapproved of Bush's handling of the war, and 60% thought it was not worth going to war. The themes of the evening, or the day, sorry, I said that, it was during the day, the themes of the speech were, you know, one, we have the Iraqis are well on their way to fighting for themselves. And I got a quote from George Bush right here. Quote, as Iraqi forces gain experience and the political process advances, we will be able to decrease our troop level in Iraq without losing our capability to defeat the terrorists. End quote. He said terrorists a lot. He brought up 9/11 within 27 seconds of starting his speech. He did explain, though, folks, that the enemy is a complex enemy with some made-up words. He made up some words to describe them. He said they are rejectionists. You ever heard of a rejectionist? They are Saddamists. I guess you just add an ISTS and it's okay. And they are terrorists. Translate to, there are desperate, angry, regular Iraqis. There are ex-Baathist Sunni insurgents. And there are jihadists from all over the world. But then he continued to call them terrorists again and again for those who couldn't quite wrap their head around the new words. Rumsfeld has grown actually dissatisfied with the word insurgent. He wants them to be called, quote, enemies of the legitimate Iraqi government. End quote. See what that does? It makes it more complicated. It diminishes its power. The word insurgent, by definition in Webster's, is, quote, a person who revolts against civil authority or an established government. It's a perfectly fine word. It really is. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about words in a second, but let me get a little further into the fact of what is going on in Iraq is that, you know, no matter how much George Bush says that this war is combating terrorism, and no matter how much he calls them terrorists, he almost was honest in really talking about what the enemy looks like in Iraq, both to us and to Iraqis in terms of the complexity of it. But the more he calls them terrorists and the more he tries to convince the American people that he's fighting a war on terror, the more he lies and the more he falls away into a delusional world. Because the bottom line is, They are killing Americans in Iraq, and jihadists are dispatching suicide bomber units out of Iraq to other countries. There is no other way to look at what is going on in Iraq other than it is a terrorist manufacturing factory. These guys, not unlike the Afghani Arabs who trained against fighting Russians in Afghanistan at our behest, with our money and with our CIA training, that begot Osama bin Laden. What you're seeing now is an entirely new generation of terrorists, disenfranchised people, committed jihadists training against Americans, killing Americans, and they are, al-Zarqawi is dispatching suicide bombers to other countries. Now, Mick Ware, who was on the show the other day, said this about what our choices are. Because Bush wants to stay, some people say, and I say, we got to get the troops out. But what are the real options? He's from Time Magazine. He spent more time on the ground in Iraq with jihadists, even, than anybody. Let's hear from Mick Ware.
Look, I've got really, really, really bad news on this. The problem is that the longer U.S. troops are here, the stronger al-Qaeda will become, and the longer the insurgency will continue. But you cannot leave now. There's an old expression, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah.
I mean, if you walked away now, if the administration walks away now, if the military disappears next month or in the beginning of next year or tomorrow, this place will implode. Civil war, terrorist organizations, just regional strife and conflict. Everyone will get sucked into this.
Yeah, well, Mick Ware is pretty much a realist, but the forecast is, you know, throughout the speech, you know, Bush said things about the commanders, like the decisions are up to the people who are on the ground, are up to the commanders. There will be no timetable set by politicians. He won't set an arbitrary timetable. And the bottom line is, you know, he is going to stay there. And I think that it's all going to align itself with his political agenda, and there is a political agenda. He'll put the onus on the Iraqis to tell President Bush, to tell him when the Americans should be out there. He'll act like he didn't know about it, and it's all going to operate right along the midterms for 2006. And I think there's going to be troops there for 10 or 15 years. I think they're going to keep changing the language, which we'll get to in a minute, to make it seem like nothing is really going on there anymore. It's 27 past. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out for the week. Stay with us.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
John Kerry likes to call it the War on Terror. That's because he lacks the moral clarity of George Bush, who knows what this is really about.
We've actually misnamed the War on Terror. It ought to be the struggle against ideological extremists who do not believe in free societies, who happen to use terror as a weapon to try to shake the conscience of the free world.
John Kerry says he can even win this so-called war on terror. That's because he lacks the strong and steady leadership of George W. Bush, who's got a better plan than just winning.
I don't think you can win it, but I think you can create conditions so that those who use terror as a tool are less acceptable in parts of the world, let's put it that way.
George W. Bush, unlike John Kerry, he's fighting the struggle against ideological extremists who do not believe in free societies, who happen to use terror as a weapon to try to shake the conscience of the free world by creating conditions so that those who use terror as a tool are less acceptable in parts of the world.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
That's right. We're tooting our own horn. It's 35 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America. I am Mark Maron. Mark Riley is out for the week. We are going to be doing that for the next 12 days or so in these last few episodes of our program. We have banked a lot of great stuff, but that particular mock ad is relevant in that yesterday, Donald Rumsfeld has stated that he's grown dissatisfied with the word insurgent. the word insurgent. He wants insurgent to be something else. He thinks that that insurgent lends the insurgents too much credibility. He has a problem with the word. All right. He wants to call them enemies of the legitimate Iraqi government. And see how that works? That's where insurgents got focus. It's got clarity. We understand what it is by the definition in Webster's. It is a person who revolts against civil authority or an established government. We get it. That's what they are. It makes perfect sense. That's a good definition. But, you know, Rumsfeld thinks it's got too much of a kick to it. So enemies of the legitimate Iraqi government, that's too many words. It doesn't have any catch to it. It sort of dissipates. It diminishes the importance of what the word insurgent means and what it characterizes in Iraq. And apparently there were some other words on the chopping block. Rebel, they were thinking about rebel, but that was too neutral. That could even be seen as a positive statement. It's certainly a romanticized statement. They tried former regime loyalists, but that's too positive because of the word loyal, because connotes that they are committed to something. Dead enders. There was one that, but they said that they thought that was too funny. Could be a sitcom. The dead enders in Iraq. You know, they are hoping that changing the language, it will look like they are doing better than they are in Iraq. Now, this has been an issue here before. I think insurgents is an appropriate definition. It is an appropriate word. It is a descriptive word. It doesn't go into exactly the makeup of what the enemy looks like, but insurgents is appropriate for almost all of the different factions of the insurgency, that being international jihadists, malcontent and angry Iraqis, and the Sunni Baathist insurgency. Now, I had a problem with the liberals defining what the insurgency was early on in the war. On this show, I got some emails that wanted to call the insurgents freedom fighters without even assessing the complexities of what was going on at the time. And I found this horrendously, I found this to be leftist romanticism, and I thought it was a heinous misunderstanding of what was going on. Here's a clip of that moment on Morning's Edition about, I guess it was probably over a year ago. I got this email yesterday, or the day before yesterday, that just stuck in my craw immediately. You should be the first liberal talking heads to stop calling the Iraqis fighting against the U.S. insurgents. In World War II, they would have been called freedom fighters or the resistance. Stop using the rights language to make them seem less than what they are. Now, I'm going to try and reframe a story that came out yesterday using this woman's language. Freedom fighters used a child with Down syndrome as a suicide bomber on election day. Okay? End quote. End reframing. Freedom fighters used a child with Down syndrome, okay, to blow himself up. Hey, go over there. See where the people are? There's candy. They'll give you candy. Yes, go over there. Okay, put this on. Okay. All right. So that's a freedom fighter. Then I get a email yesterday from a real ass, a first-class leftist fascist ass. With a show like yours, who needs Rush? Really? Do you listen to our show? Since our occupying force is not legitimate, they are not insurgents, but freedom fighters. That is, if you think that a freedom fighter's tactic is using a retarded kid to blow people up, not just people, to blow the same people of their same country up. So they're blowing up their own people with retarded children that don't know better. All right, so does the jihadist who says, hey, come here, retarded boy, does the jihadist who says that, do you really think that he's got a better vision for Iraq? Come here, retarded boy. I know you don't understand the Quran. I know you don't understand what we're doing here, but look at this. It's fun. Here, put this on. This is fun, retarded boy. Now go over there and get the candy from the people. Does the guy who said that have a better plan for Iraq, you moron, you ass? And then here's the funny thing. At the end of his email, he says, it's back to Stern for me.
Oh, yeah.
I get what it is. You just want to see retarded people made fun of anyway. You don't care if retarded people die or they voluntarily lose their dignity on Howard Stern. So your problem is with retarded people, you arrogant, hateful turd. Come here. Hey, come here, little boy. Oh, he's retarded. I don't care. Put the bomb on him. Run over there. Get the candy. God bless the freedom fighters. Wow, that was back when I was eating M&Ms and drinking a lot of coffee and offending people who get offended at the word retarded. I remember getting emails about that saying, why do you believe the press? That who knows who made up that story, whether that story was real. It wasn't really the issue, now was it? Let's talk about Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. Alito, despite, he's been running around. Apparently, everyone loves him in New Jersey. A lot of people think he's just a swell guy. But listen, here's the bottom line. I think this guy is gunning for Roe v. Wade. There is no doubt about it. He should be grilled to the nth degree during the panel. Because back in 85, when he was with the Reagan administration as an assistant to the Solicitor General is the person, it's the office that represents the federal government in front of the Supreme Court. He added, that in defending the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, this is our guy. This is Samuel Alito. This is the nominee. Some of the act's provision had been overturned by the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in a case called the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists versus Thornburg. A memo in reference to the case by Alito was released yesterday, and in it he said, quote, no one seriously believes that the court is about to overrule Roe v. Wade. By taking these cases, this court may be signaling an inclination to cut back. What can be made out of this opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade and, in the meantime, of mitigating its effects? End quote. Let's be clear. This guy wants to make it impossible, if not illegal, for abortion to be performed safely in this country. What his plan was, and it's devious, because he wants to chip away at other abortion cases in front of the Supreme Court that don't really touch Roe v. Wade per se, but eventually if you chip away at the one that's in front of the court today, the New Hampshire one, if you chip away at them, eventually Roe v. Wade will not have anything to stand on. And Alito wants to relegate the health of women who need to terminate their pregnancy, for whatever their reasons, to dangerous environments or clinics hundreds of miles away from where they live, if not in another country altogether. He wants to enslave women to the decisions of the Supreme Court when it comes to making choices in relation to the civil rights and their rights to reproductive freedom. See, my bottom line with this thing is, as I'm starting to realize, is that this is what judicial activism looks like. The difference between conservatives and liberals is liberals engage in a conversation, engage in a debate within themselves. A conservative, they don't change their mind. I mean, that's what's clear. The reason this guy lived his entire life honoring his conservative ideology, protecting his conservative ideology. There is no difference between his ideology and his agenda and his ability to interpret the law. I don't care what kind of nice guy this is. The bottom line is, I think it is impossible for him to separate his ideology as a conservative and what those beliefs are with his ability to interpret the law. I hope that they grill this guy. I hope that they push him out, because I think he's dangerous. I don't care if he's the greatest guy in the world. I know I made reference to a case there, and I just throw these ideas around like I inherently know what I'm talking about, but the Thornburg versus American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists was basically a case in which the Pennsylvania state law that required physicians to inform women contemplating an abortion of the detrimental physical and psychological effects was constitutional. Was it okay? Is it okay for a doctor to have to say to someone getting an abortion, like, this could really screw up your body, and it's certainly going to screw your head up for God knows how long? So a group of doctors challenged Pennsylvania's anti-abortion legislation, especially the provisions requiring women to be told of the detrimental and physical effects of the abortion. The U.S. Courts of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled in favor of the doctors, declaring the provisions in the legislation to be unconstitutional. The state of Pennsylvania appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the challenged provisions in Pennsylvania's anti-abortion legislation were in fact unconstitutional because they obstructed a woman's right to an abortion. Now, not unlike what's going on in New Hampshire, where they're challenging this, the minors having to tell their parents what is going down there is that yesterday the Supreme Court heard these arguments from the state of New Hampshire and from the Planned Parenthood attorney. And basically the issue is that there needs to be provisions in there to protect the minor's health no matter what. if the minor shows up at an emergency room and needs to terminate a pregnancy because she will die, a doctor should be able to do that without having to call the kid's parents or call a judge, because you could be losing time. But these are the type of laws they're going to chip away at, to chip away at the woman's ability to have the freedom to choose what they will do with their own bodies and to choose what they will do with their reproductive system. So Alito's plan from the beginning, from the 80s, was to chip away at these laws so Roe v. Wade really has nothing to stand on. And I think he'll continue to do that, and certainly if he's aligned with John Roberts, who's the new Chief Justice, that is their goal. They may not turn back Roe v. Wade, but they will certainly make it almost useless. It's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio. We'll have some funny stuff in a minute.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week on Morning Sedition Radio Theater, our radio company asked the burning question, where will Mark Maron work when he goes to the City of Angels?
Just in time for Valentine's Day, Paris Hilton is releasing a DVD box set of all her home sex videos with past boyfriends. The 8-DVD set will come in a heart-shaped box and will include extras like audio commentary and a making-of documentary. Wait a minute. Stop tape.
What's wrong, Mark?
I can't do this. Paris Hilton, come on. I just spent 2 years talking about the important issues in this country every day, like the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Boring.
Political corruption.
Boring.
The neocon death cult behind George Bush is trying to wipe out our freedom to choose what movies we see and what TV shows we watch and what kind of people we can marry.
They're really doing that right now in the United States of America?
Yes, they are.
Boring.
That's it. I'm out of here.
Wait, Mark. It sounds like you were really passionate about your last job.
Passionate? I got up at 3:15 in the morning every day for 2 years.
Stop kidding around, Mark. Only an idiot would get up that early. Just let me ask you, how much did Air America appreciate all your hard work and passion? Because this is how much we appreciate it. Andrea, show Mark the check again.
So check out those Paris Hilton DVDs. We'll be back with my exclusive interview of Danny Bonaducci.
That's Mark Maron's future on Morning Sedition Radio Theater. Turn that music off. Turn it off!
All right, 52 past the hour. Could that happen? Is that possible? I've made bad choices in my life in the past times, but that was really because I was bankrupt. I remember that one. Never mind the Buzzcocks. Some people remember seeing one or two episodes of that on VH1. I'm sorry, but I just gotten divorced, and I was in the hole bad. And it didn't really take, did it? Didn't really take, because it was a British show, and they made a remake of it, and I was the host of it. It was a pretty rough couple weeks, I'll tell you. Hey, for fans of sharp objects, there's good news. You can now fly with your pointy things again, friends. Airport security screeners have been given the okay to let people on planes with scissors under 4 inches long and tools shorter than 7 inches. Homeland Security Department officials said that they are more focused on finding suicide bombers and things that explode than scissors. Wow, that only took them 4 years to make that decision. I think once they put the locks on those cabins, once they locked up the crew and the pilot, they realized that the sharp things could only hurt the stewardesses. So screw it. Let's just let them back on with the scissors. But I think that they've got their heart in the right place. And I think that that the scissors are not really what's going to be the big threat. I think blowing things up is obviously the new and big threat. It has been a threat for a long time. The box cutter episode was a freak event, friends. Let me tell you. Well, my friend Jack had an issue with this, and he had my friend Jack Boulware, who's a writer out in San Francisco, is down in Chile covering a story. Hopefully we'll get him on the phone to talk about this, but it's a little early for him out there. But apparently, before he left Chile, he was down on the docks taking it in before he left the country, and a couple of fishermen came up to him. He got to talking to him, and they gave him a 3-foot-long swordfish beak. And, of course, Jack needed to take it home, so he had them wrap it up, and he was going to bring it on a plane. Apparently, he made it out of from Santiago to Atlanta, but once he got to Atlanta, they started poking around. He couldn't put it in his bag, so he had to put it in his backpack, so he's got this swordfish beak sticking out of his backpack, and a couple, apparently three dudes came over, pulled him aside. They had to check whether the species was endangered. They had to decide whether or not it was dangerous, and bottom line, they let him through. They let him through, and then he gets to another checkpoint when he has to change planes again, and it's starting to stink, apparently. It's starting to stink up the plane, and they let him through again. So now he gets home with this 3-foot-long swordfish beak that he's been told will take 1 year to dry out, and he's like, he just wanted the challenge of getting a swordfish beak through customs from Chile to San Francisco, and he succeeded. Now he doesn't know what to do with it, but he says it's pretty cool. Huh? Yeah, that's how's that.
I love the image of the new terrorist threat of these guys running around a cabin of an airplane with these swordfish beaks.
Sorry, that's it. They could actually
give
get
us
them
control to plane.
We've got the fish beaks. Oh my God! I read one of these stories. I guess we'll talk about it in the next hour. We might as well lighten up a little bit. It seems like a pretty heavy day. I've already talked about terrorism, abortion, and now fish beaks and AIDS, of course. Today is World AIDS Day, where awareness is very important to make sure people still realize. I'll tell a story after the top of the hour about, I could probably tell it now. The one thing that you don't have to do with AIDS now is kill yourself. I was in.
So this is looking up.
Yeah, yeah.
More positive.
Yeah, I wanted to turn it around a little bit, man. Yeah, no? No, it's interesting because in the mid-80s, I had a friend who had a friend who was dying. And he called me because I was a druggie, and he asked me flat out. I mean, I was never a big druggie, a little pot, a little blow, you know the story, same stuff. Regular stuff, not crazy. Well, I got a little crazy. But he asked me, he said, is there any way you can get enough painkillers or secanols or barbiturates so I can euthanize my friend who's dying of this disease? And it was just, I remember that week was just horrifying to me because I wanted to help out, but it put me in a position to try to find something highly illegal. I felt bad for my friend. I felt bad for the guy who was passing away. And it really brought the entire situation of the hopelessness at that time home. And one thing that you do know now, if you get tested, if you realize that you're sick, is that they do have treatments that can help you live a relatively healthy life for many years, and possibly even, you know, transcend the illness altogether. That's what they're really moving towards, is making it a treatable illness that does not kill you. So things have really progressed in that way. If you can get the medication you need, if it is available to you, if your health plan covers it or it's affordable, that stuff needs to be worked on. But awareness is important. Get tested. It's still out there. And today is World AIDS Day. And when we come back, let's talk about love and talk about the chemical foundations of love and whether or not love is real. How's that? Is that better? Is that a good transition? 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. People, it's 6 past the hour. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is our show, Morning Sedition. This is almost the 12th to the last show. We'll be off by the 16th. The 16th is the last Morning Sedition program. Hope you stay with us. We're going to be having some fun, playing some greatest hits, moving along. Mark Riley is out this week. He's probably up. Maybe not. It's hard to, once you get on the schedule, you do wake up early naturally. You never quite get it right on weekends. But he'll be back Monday, and that'll give us 2 weeks together to put the closure that we need on this thing. So look, let me, should I do the Cliff Notes right now? Maybe, let me save that for a minute. I do want to say I left a story hanging. Today is World AIDS Day. Please raise your own awareness and realize that this disease is still out there. There have been 3 million deaths in the past year of AIDS. There have been 5 million new infections this year. Infection rates are rising in nearly every part of the world. Not so much in the United States because I think education has worked, but 95% of the total number of people with HIV worldwide live in the developing world. I was talking about earlier, just before the break, about a story about a friend of mine who I knew in college. A guy who had a friend who was dying of AIDS, and he called me to try to procure enough drugs for this guy to end his life because he was in such so much pain. Ultimately, I didn't need to do that. He let me off the hook, and the guy passed naturally. But the bottom line, the point of that is if you get tested, if you understand that you have the disease, there are options today that there weren't in the early and mid-80s. There are drugs that can prolong your life if you can get them. So it's very important to get tested and also to be as safe as possible when you have sex with people you don't know. Even people you do know, until you know that you're both clean. It's 8 past the hour. We're going to talk a little bit now about Bush, who spoke to a fixed house at the Naval Academy in Annapolis last night and tried to resell the tired, stay the course agenda to the American people. He talked a lot about terrorists. He talked a lot about commanders will make decisions. He talked about the good judgment of our commanders. He also talked about he's not going to set artificial timetables set by politicians in Washington. The idea that George Bush thinks he can still sell the BS that he is not an insider when he is surrounded by advisors and a vice president that are under investigation for being criminally inside is just laughable to me. I mean, he's hoping that he can make everything coincide with his own political agenda, because the bottom line is the Pentagon has plans to pull some 17,000 troops out shortly after the Iraqi elections in December, then another 38,000 in mid-2006. That's midterm 2006. So I think the bottom line, I said this yesterday, the Bush strategy is to just sit and wait until he gets the information that he wants from his commanders to keep the troops in Iraq until the Iraqis, at his backdoor insistence, request a partial pullout around the end of December that makes it look like democracy is taking hold. And then he'll pay lip service to pulling a few thousand more out for a few months until Republicans campaigning in the midterms can realign themselves with him and his war message. Then he'll pull out several thousand just in time for the voters to feel like he did something. Yet this is a plan that the Pentagon has on the table now. After mid-2006, there will still be 100,000 U.S. troops sitting in Iraq for maybe, I think, what's going to be 10 to 15 years, or at least until a Democrat deals with it properly when one is elected in 2008. I think this is still going to be an issue. Now, if you listen to somebody like our guest for the other day, Mick Ware, Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, in terms of whether there should be a pullout or shouldn't be, I mean, he has a very, the way he phrases it, you know, let me tell you, I mean, it's an existential apocalyptic conundrum. Listen to this.
Look, I've got really, really, really bad news on this. The problem is that the longer U.S. troops are here, the stronger Al-Qaeda will become, and the longer the insurgency will continue. But you cannot leave now. There's an old expression, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah.
I mean, if you walked away now, if the administration walks away now, if the military disappears next month or in the beginning of next year or tomorrow, this place will implode. Civil war, terrorist organizations, just regional strife and conflict. Everyone will get sucked into this.
Yeah, and then he went on to say that the alternative is to commit for 15 to 20 years. So whatever, you know, lip service that President Bush is paying to eventually getting out of there, I think is really a lie. I think that they have every intention of keeping a troop force of about 100,000 there until the end of time. And it's not about fighting terrorism. It just isn't, because it is doing nothing but exacerbating global terrorism. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. In his speech yesterday, President Bush offered no new strategy or timetable for getting out of Iraq. Bush said Iraqi units are controlling more territory, growing more independent, and even regaining the confidence to commit indiscriminate torture again. A study says that the powerful emotions involved with falling in love are triggered by a specific molecule and don't last more than a year. Italian scientists found far higher levels of the love molecule in the blood of 58 people who had recently fallen madly in love than in that of a group of people in long-term relationships. Interesting note, the love molecule is composed of 99% tequila. After a year, the love molecules are replaced with alcohol and porn for men and alcohol and food for women. By measuring the level of nerve growth factor, scientists have proven that passionate love cannot last for more than 1 year. Except in my marriage, baby. Of course, so don't worry if you're listening. This story doesn't apply to us, of course. Certain sharp objects like scissors are going to be allowed back on airplanes under new rules to be announced tomorrow. The announcement was great news for the deadly Al-Qaeda cell, the Barbers of Baghdad, who are rumored to have an exploding comb, brush, and scissor set that can take out an entire 747. Okay, that's that. All right? Am I a little tired today? What's going on? Here goes the garbage. Hey, so that is true. And I don't know how I feel about this. I have some thoughts. I mean, everything can obviously be broken down to a chemical reaction or some sort of subatomic activity. So I don't give a lot of credence to studies that look at things as important as falling or being in love as being solely chemical reactions. But the molecule known as NGF, nerve growth factor, is at the bottom of that that exciting feeling of euphoria, silliness, anxiousness, and the initial throes of being in love. An Italian study found that people who were newly in love and had high levels of NGF in their system, and people who have been in love over a year had significantly lower levels. They found higher levels of a molecule that causes bitterness, disappointment, and frustration in those people, but not NGF. But the weird thing is, when you're in a relationship, like I was trying to think about this, there is definitely a difference of feeling between that being in love or having a crush or being just sort of exhilarated or obsessed with somebody than there is when you're in a long-term relationship. I think some of that has to do with once you cross the line into actually consummating a sexual act or being with the person in a very intimate way, it sort of shifts to something different, to a more mental element, a commitment. And if you do not distract yourself with other things from that person, I think you can keep it going for a long time. But I think that initial moment, that initial few weeks of being in love, that kind of comes and goes, doesn't it? Even when you're in a relationship, don't you get crushes, man? Can we talk about this openly? Chris, somebody, throw something in. No one's going to go on.
Brennan?
Throw it on the newly married guy. Because even, not crushes that you act on, but sometimes if you get a little juice from somebody, you're like, oh, wow, that's
it. Oh, of course.
And you kind of feel that for a few days, but you don't pursue it, and it sort of goes away. I think that's sort of the same thing.
Is that cheating, though?
Come on, that's not. No, of course not.
But I think with this,
it's something
thing
you don't talk about.
Yeah, but what this thing is bringing up is exactly is raising the question of why exactly you get married. So are you getting married, and are you being in a relationship with someone based on this passionate impulse that you have, or is it about something completely different than that? Because I've been with who is now my current wife. I've been with her for almost 7 years.
Right. But do you think it's really talking about marriage, or you think it's talking about understanding?
Why do people get married? A lot of people would say they get married because they found the love of their life and they had that reaction to this molecular impulse that you're talking about.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, we're grown people. I mean, you were with her like, what, 5-6 years before you got married? I mean, you know that, you know, once you got past that molecular impulse, that there was something deeper and more, that you had a different other things that made you bond and have things in common.
Right, but I think the problem is that too many people, just the same way that they view all happiness, they think that it is that concentrated brief moment of happiness and joy that should perpetuate itself.
I tell you, I think the most important thing, honestly, is not the elation or euphoria you feel when you're just newly in love with somebody, but it is wanting to sleep with them. It is wanting to be with them. It is the continuing sexual interest that keeps love alive. And then after that, you have to be their friend. There's so many other elements. And I really think that 9 times out of 10, this feeling of euphoria, anxiety, and just complete infatuation, as soon as you have sex, dissipates into something else. I really,
so are you saying that's how you find a life partner? Is if things are good after the sex?
Yes. Yes. I mean, on some level, you have your instincts, you have this biological feeling that happens, but you have to be compatible that way, or else you have nothing to fall back on when you have a fight.
Well, we got to find out from other people what they think.
866-303-2270. Look, if you don't really love somebody or really have good sex, what about one of those fights where, you know, there's broken things on the floor and you're both crying and someone's about to leave? If you can't at least bank on the fact that at that moment you can just, you know, flop onto the couch and do something that's amazing, then you're lost.
Wait, but isn't the fight where all the broken things are on the floor, isn't that a sign that maybe you guys shouldn't be together?
No.
No.
No, come on.
Everybody fights and breaks things.
Yeah, come on. Once you break... Well, you know, that's... I'm exaggerating. I don't throw or break things. You know, I remember there was one time when I was in college, I threw a beer bottle down the hallway, and I remember it because I was, like, pissed off. I was yelling at this woman, Sarah, and I threw the beer bottle down the hall. It hit the door, and it didn't break, and I felt so impotent. It just went thunk, and I'm like, oh, man. Couldn't even broken. Well, what do you think? 866-303-2270. How does love last? Let's change the tone of the show. Can we have some fun? 17 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
All right, 22 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. Mark Riley's on vacation. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In the midst of it all, in the hurricane of everything that's going on politically, internationally, globally, all the horror, we're talking about love because a molecule has been found that causes that feeling you have when you fall in love, that elation, that euphoria, that anxious excitement that makes you all giddy until you have sex, and then it changes into something else. And is this what love is based on? Is this what marriage is based on? I think not. I think that what it is based on. Well, let's ask you. Let's talk to some people. Andre in Ohio, what do you have to say about it?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to comment on what the guy said, that sex has a lot, or plays a lot into it. I just disagree with that.
Really?
I don't think sex has nothing to do with long-lasting love and marriage.
Are you serious? I mean, I'm the guy, by the way. But
okay.
Yeah, but you really don't think that has anything to do with it?
No, I feel that you fall in love with someone's mind and their intellect. Sex is just something added, you know, there, and it's a fleshly thing that's there.
A fleshly thing?
Yes, and I do believe that fleshly. You know, it's not a bad thing. But when you say you love someone, you love someone for better or for worse. So if you're having bad sex, do you still love them?
No. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Well,
No. I think it all has to come. If you're having bad sex, you got to figure out how to get it good again, because I think it's very important
that. I think too much weight is being put on a couple. As far as having sex, what if whatever you do, the sex ain't any good, you know? And I think that you have to learn to love the person for who they are and what they are, and you love them, you love their mind and their intellect and who they are, the character that they carry.
Well, it seems to me that
I've been married for 9 years, and I'm madly in love with my wife. I do have good sex, though.
That's good.
But you know, there's times we you know, don't have sex for a while.
Yeah.
But it's not because we have bad sex. It's because we just, you know, we're tied up into our lives
and
our work.
But don't you get back to it? I mean, what I'm saying is that if it's all going, if the person is your friend, if you have this intimacy, if you have a good connection, and if the sex is there or it was there, at least you have something to fall back on. What I'm hearing you say is, you know, sometimes it's frustrating. You don't get to do what you want or have the sex you want. Or sometimes the sex is disappointing, but at least you know that the bottom line is all your ducks in a row. You're in love with her mind. You think she's a great person. She's your friend. And the sex is good when it's good. And sometimes it's not so good. But I understand what you're saying, but I think to underestimate the power of sexual attraction is crazy, because I think after the infatuation is gone, granted you have an understanding of that person, you guys are friends, but come on. Ernie in Nashville, we've got a minute or two. What's up?
Hey, man, I agree with you completely. I've been married twice. I'm on my second marriage.
Uh-huh.
And the first one, I knew within 2 weeks that it was going to be a long haul. I didn't just throw in the towel,
yeah.
But I knew.
Yeah.
And this time, you know, it's completely different. My wife and I both agree that, you know, when we're intimate, we can shut the rest of the world out And no matter how bad other things are going, that is always good. And that's a good thing to keep a relationship strong. And
I agree.
You know, in fact, it's, we're celebrating this next month, 7 years. I'm flying out to Vegas with her tonight to celebrate our anniversary this weekend.
Oh, well, happy anniversary. Let me ask
you. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, man. Ernie, let me ask you a question. I don't want to bring it up if it's uncomfortable to you. But
no problem.
In your first marriage, did you have that thing? Did you have that euphoria, that being in love, that moment? Did you have that with her?
No, I really didn't. And the thing was is my background was from an extremely strict fundamentalist religious background, and you know, sex before marriage was wrong. And not that I'm saying that people shouldn't try to, you know, if that's their core belief, they shouldn't hold to that. But I really honestly feel like it would have saved us both a lot of time and pain, you know, had we sampled that portion of our relationship and found out whether or not we were compatible.
Yeah, to me, that kind of thinking where you deny yourself sex until you're married, they're just promoting misery. They're trying to guarantee that people will go to church forever because they're pretty much banking on the fact that 90% of those people that don't have sex before they're married are going to be miserable. That's what I think. So look, it seems to be a pretty provocative topic, and I appreciate your call. We've got Susan Jacoby, who is coming up. I've always liked talking to her. She's the author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. Maybe we can talk about sex with her. I don't know. Are we taking any more calls? We're done with that. We can? Well, stay on the phone. Let's keep talking about it. I think it's kind of interesting, because I do love my wife right now, and I've been in relationships that weren't full of love. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley is out for the week. We're going to take one more call about this, the idea that at the core of being in love, or that moment, that feeling of euphoria, elation, excitement, anxiety is a chemical reaction, obviously, but does it have any real, does it pertain to real love at all in most cases, or is it just something that comes and goes? Kristen in Arizona, how are you? What do you say about it?
Well, I think it's there for just to kind of get you through that beginning part of a relationship.
Uh-huh.
So you get to know the person.
Right.
But I personally don't really like that feeling. Mm. I mean, I like it. It's addictive, but it makes me incredibly anxious because I'm worried, oh, does the person feel the same about me? Are they got the same chemicals flowing through their brain that I do? Or,
right. So
I just want to get past that. I just want to be plopped into a nice, stable relationship with somebody who is my friend and I'd have known forever.
Maybe they'll have the pills that can do that. Where you both take it and it feels like you've been together 5 years.
Ooh, I like that.
All right, thanks for your call, Kristen. All right, well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you can't trust it, but I do think that what she said is important in that, because I felt this with my current wife. I knew right when I saw her that if we can make this work, if I can follow through these feelings, that this was going to be it for me. And I still feel that. So let's move into something different. The religious right is out to convince Americans that the U.S. Constitution never really meant to stipulate a separation between church and state. Fortunately, our next guest is out to set the record straight, my friends. In the December issue of Mother Jones Magazine, she's written an article entitled Original Intent, in which she argues that the fact that the word God doesn't appear in the U.S. Constitution was neither an accident nor an oversight. She's also the author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, which is out in paperback. Author Susan Jacoby joins us in the studio this morning. Good to see you, Susan. Welcome back.
I'm happy to be here, and I don't want that pill that makes me fall out of love.
Well, I think it's just to level people off, to feel comfortable and not all freaked out, but I feel that way anyway.
You could feel comfortable and freaked out at the same time.
You don't got to tell me. I'm freaking out right now, Susan, at all times. So let's talk. You want to start with Alito, because there was some indication today that this guy is going to, he is what you would call a revisionist, yes?
Well, The story about Alito today just shows a lot more details about his real views on abortion.
Yeah.
Which some of his supporters are trying to make out like that was only because he was working for the Reagan administration that somehow he's somehow changed and become open-minded.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Well,
I believe,
of course,
yeah.
that's absolute nonsense. If he didn't believe this, he wouldn't have been working for the Reagan administration. It's just, it's plain silly. But how this does tie into revision is that I think the question that senators should be asking Alito is not, they shouldn't be asking him about abortion. He's going to lie. He's not going to answer. They never will. They should ask him, do you believe that the Constitution and the government derive their power from God? And if he does, they shouldn't vote to confirm him.
Because that is not what the designers of this democracy had set out for us.
Absolutely not. It's not that many of them didn't believe in God. It's that they had a proper view of the need for separation between religion and government. And why wouldn't they have? They were writing the Constitution 20 years after the last execution for blasphemy took place in France. They had before them the examples of Europe and all of the horrors of union of church and state.
Yeah, well, it continues today. This is an interesting thing. I just read a transcript from Bill O'Reilly comment that it seems to me that secular states and secular nations, you know, are much calmer. They're much more rational. They take care of their populace in a way that is respectable. What is it that frightens people in this country, these particular people, so much?
Well, first of all, the astonishing thing about these people is Americans as a people are the most religious people in the developed world. That is related to separation of church and state, because here, if you didn't like your religion, it didn't translate into having to be opposed to the state. You just went off and founded another religion. Now, you may, as a secular person, not look upon all of these religions as a great thing. The fact is, religion has flourished here under separation of church and state. But what we have with people like O'Reilly and the Protestant Christian right is very simple. What they want is for their brand of religion to be predominant. That is what the Ten Commandments cases are all about. And we have people like Scalia, Bush's favorite judge, who, as far as I can see, his views are identical to Alito's, saying in his Ten Commandments case dissent that the court majority was wrong to order the removal from courthouses. Why? Because, Scalia said, our historical traditions show that the Constitution clearly permits disregard of polytheists, believers in unconcerned deities, that means a lot of the people who wrote the Constitution, and devout atheists. Well, of course, the Constitution permits nothing of the kind. It says nothing about God.
Yeah. We are talking to Susan Jacoby. She's the author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. She has a piece in the current Mother Jones magazine entitled Original Intent. And in that article, you write about an argument back in the 1800s over the delivery of mail on Sundays. what was that all about, and how did it get resolved?
Well, Congress originally mandated Sunday mail because in the days before the telegraph and so on, it was the only way business could get done if the mails kept moving on Sunday. There were, beginning early in the 19th century, movements of right-wing ministers saying this was sacrilegious. It all kind of came to a head in 1828, and the Senate referred the whole matter to the chairman of the Senate Committee on the Post Office and Post Roads,
yeah,
who happened to be a devout Baptist. And he wrote a report just excoriating the idea of ending Sunday mail service, saying, first of all, that this would be a violation of separation of church and state. And he said, quote, the line cannot be too sharply drawn, so much for people who say separation of church and state is a lie of the left. And what was interesting is this report was read and widely reprinted, and it led to Congress not taking any action on this, leaving the Sunday mails in place. And it shows that in the early part of the Republic, people had a healthy sense of the difference between religion as a matter of conscience, as a private matter. And by the way, one of the things Johnson pointed out was that lots of religious Americans did not celebrate their Sabbath on Sunday, but on Saturday.
Interesting. So now, what do you think about this whole wedge that Jerry Falwell is trying to reinitiate some sort of fury over what he sees as a leftist or secular conspiracy against Christmas? It's ridiculous.
Well, you walk around New York, you look at all the decorations, you hear the carols blasting on radio stations 24 hours a day. All I could say is if somebody's waging a war on Christmas, it's a singularly unsuccessful, futile, and hopeless enterprise. I mean, you might as well wage war on the tides or the hurricanes or whatever.
Exactly. But isn't this what he's doing? Isn't he trying to keep this cultural division alive?
Look, there is a serious matter at the core here. One of the things that really bugs O'Reilly was going on about this yesterday on the Today Show is there in many public schools, various groups don't want Christmas carols to be sung. And, you know, I think about that. I went to both public and parochial schools when I was a kid in the 1950s, and we did sing Christmas carols in public schools then. And I don't think anybody ever thought that singing Away in the Manger for the minority of Jewish kids, let's say, might not be so much fun. But here's the thing. What this is really about, all at its core, the religious right, they can call it Judeo-Christian, all they want. It's about saying to people who aren't Christians, we're in charge here, guys. Love it or leave it. That's what it's about. I mean, obviously, American Christian children are not deprived of the opportunity to sing or hear Christmas carols.
Yeah.
Frankly, I think they should be studying a little history or math in school instead of singing the first Noel in Away in a Manger.
Or at least learning about other cultures.
Yeah. But it's serious, though. I mean, the fact is that it could be very well offensive to people who practice other religions to be forced to participate in this. And I have a lot of friends who remember that. It's not that. Also, the comical thing about the war on Christmas is it has become such an overwhelmingly secular holiday.
Absolutely. It's just a vacation. It's a time to get gifts. You get certain foods. People get used to it.
But the religious aspect of it belongs in homes and schools for people who believe it. You know, next thing, they'll be wanting to celebrate Easter in the public schools, too.
Exactly. Now, I guess the big question is, you know, you talk candidly about this. I talk candidly about this being an almost atheist. And I get a lot of flack. I get flack from progressive people who feel that I'm being anti-religion or anti-Christian. How do people react to you in conversation or in letters?
Well, it depends on who they are. I've spoken at a lot of universities in the South in the last year where everybody's a Christian, it seems. But interestingly, the students have asked me a lot of questions, and the questions always start out with this. I am a Christian, but I believe in equal rights for homosexuals. Or I am a Christian, but I believe in a woman's right to choose. And what I always tell them is that there are lots of Christian communities where you can say, I am a Christian and.
Yeah.
But I think that there are people who are people of faith who believe that anybody who says they're an atheist is insulting them. I don't know why. I just don't believe in God. But there is something that does insult people. I respect people's right to believe whatever they want, as is not only personally, but as a constitutional obligation. But I do not respect the beliefs themselves. That is to say, people can believe, for instance, that the earth was created in 7 days. That's their constitutional right. But I don't respect that belief. I think it's idiotic.
Right, exactly.
And so in America, we confuse belief in the right of people to believe what they want with respect for the beliefs themselves. And I think about that, we're altogether too polite.
They're using it to.
The religious right has a right to be offended by my views and not to respect them. And I'm certainly offended by their views, and I don't respect their views.
Well, I think what you said earlier is at the core of this, because I'll speak openly about this, and I think that when somebody says they're being tolerant, or when you say you're an atheist, that's one thing, but when you say, even if you have a different religion, if you say to a Christian, I'm a Jewish person, they'll go, oh, well, that's good. I'm glad you can practice your faith. But secretly, just by nature of monotheism, they have to believe that their God is the only God, so they're just indulging you, and then really they're like, oh, you're going to hell.
Of course. Well, look at the Christian right and its Left Behind scenario.
Yeah.
They present themselves and are such big supporters of the State of Israel because it's the land of the Bible. But what they really believe is that on the day Christ comes back on Armageddon, all of those Israelis who haven't accepted Christ, well, they're going right into the fiery pit.
Exactly.
Along with us.
Right. Exactly. But right now they're appreciating the Israelis' move to move as many Arabs as possible out of Jerusalem that will facilitate the second coming.
Right.
So now, I guess the question I want to ask, in a worst-case scenario, if Alito gets confirmed, and we have Alito and John Roberts in there. What is your big fear as somebody who writes about and respects deeply, as I do, the separation between church and state? What's the worst thing that can happen?
Well, I think it's going to change the balance on the court in all church-state cases, because Sandra Day O'Connor has been, in general, a strong supporter of separation of church and state, and she has often been a swing vote in those cases. Certainly, what we are talking now is the replacement of a swing vote that's often voted on the side of church-state separation with Alito, from whatever I can read about his record, and he has said it and written it, and he came out of seeing Arlen Specter, and the senators were very happy that he said, well, separation of church and state is gone too far.
Yeah, that's very scary to me, because I believe what you said, that the conservative ideology, these are guys that commit to this ideology early on, and
that
is who they are. There is no separation. This idea that somebody can separate from their ability to weigh judicial matters crazy.
I would say that they should simply ask Alito, do you agree with Scalia's view that the Constitution permits disregard of atheists and so forth and people of unconventional religious beliefs?
Well, I hope that there
is. And if he, it doesn't matter whether he answers, if he tries to wiggle it out of it, those senators ought to get some backbone and vote against him.
I think you're absolutely right, and I hope that some of the senators heard you here today, and I hope they have the guts to take this guy on. I don't understand.
Yes, Olympia Snow, Arlen Specter, I'm talking to you folks.
Exactly. Let's get a little backbone. I don't know why everyone has to be so damn polite. Susan Jacoby, author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, thank you for joining us. Also, you have the article, Original Intent and the new Mother Jones. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
You bet. It's 48 past the hour. Johnny K Street, I see you in the booth. He's probably got to get going to court, so let's get him in here. It's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Dar Williams. After a long night of electric guitar solos, pyrotechnics, trashed hotel rooms, and bad eating, I listen to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, folks, we got Tim Robbins coming up. It's 53 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. There are a lot of big stories in the news this week, people, so let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny K Street. Johnny, where's the action, man?
All right, I got a rack action, baby.
Uh-huh.
Are we in? Are we out? Are we in? Are we out? That's all anyone can talk about in Washington right now. There hasn't been this much discussion about early withdrawal since the last papal conference on birth control.
Oh, man. Did you watch Bush's speech yesterday?
Oh, yeah, I T-boned it. I wouldn't want to miss a second of that brilliant oratory. Stay the course, my ass. The last time I saw someone blow that much smoke was Woody Harrelson's birthday party. According to our commander in chief, the Iraq security forces are gaining control of the country. Great. Perfect timing. They should have everything under control just in time for us to bomb Iraq off the face of the earth. That's Bush's new plan. Get the troops out and replace them with bombs. Of course, he's so stupid, his original plan was to bomb Iraq, then get the troops out.
So, Johnny, do you believe that the Iraqi forces are better trained and closer to defending themselves the way the president described it yesterday?
Sure, I believe that. And I believe that Paris Hilton will discover a cure for cancer. And I'll get to do Angelina Jolie for Christmas because I asked Santa Claus real nice.
All right, so give us a line on whether Bush's plan is going to be effective or not.
Considering the fact that Bush has never been effective at anything in his entire life, I'd say the odds are 1,000 to 1.
All right, that sounds good to me. I'll take that for a grand, Johnny.
Hey, Johnny. What do you think about the transcript that shows Bush wanted to bomb Al Jazeera in 2004 and Tony Blair talked him out of it? What are the chances, what are the odds that Bush was just joking like he said he was?
Well, taking action on whether George Bush was planning to do something stupid is like taking action on whether the sun will come out tomorrow, as was so beautifully put in a smash Broadway hit, Annie.
Wow, Johnny, I never knew you were a fan of the Broadway musical.
Don't judge me. What are you saying?
Nothing, man.
Wise ass?
Yeah, maybe a little.
As far as Bush goes, I guarantee he was going to bomb Al Jazeera, and I'll give you 500 to 1 on it. I can understand it. I watched 5 minutes of Breaking Bonaducci. I wanted to bomb VH1. Oh, before I forget, I had dinner the other night with Bob Woodward.
Wait a minute.
Oh, you're friends with Bob Woodward?
We go all the way back to the break-in, wow. Baby. Long story. He's writing the foreword to my book, You Bet My Life, the Johnny K Street story. You won't believe this. He told me he knew a year ago that Mark was going to leave Morning Sedition, but he was afraid to mention it. Do you believe that?
I don't know, man.
That reminds me, if I may digress for 1 minute.
Yeah.
Remember, folks, Christmas is coming up, and my book, You Bet My Life, the Johnny K Street story, makes a great stocking stuffer. Put it in your Christmas list. It's a page turner.
All right. So, Johnny, speaking of Christmas, what do you got planned for Christmas?
I'm going to do what I usually do. Me and my cousin Jimmy Knob Street are going to take our annual Christmas pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Vegas.
No, Vatican City.
You're going to Vatican City?
Yes, I am. Vatican City is my kind of town, baby.
Well, are you going to try to get an audience with the Pope, Johnny?
I better have an audience with the Pope. He's into me for 40 large on football. The way his vig is piling up, he should be kissing my ring, for starters.
Hey, wait, isn't it a sin to gamble, man?
You show me in the Bible where it says, thou shalt not bet the point spread, all right? If the Pope wants to lay off some action, who am I to say he can't? But he'll cast the first stone, live in a glass house, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, he called me up last week and wanted to lay off another 10 large on the Giants. I said, Your Holiness, you better get yourself a bigger collection basket or start praying for a miracle. Even Christ couldn't carry your vig up Calvary. The Pope's all right, though. We'll get together, put a few away. When he gets loaded, he calls heaven and hell the over and under. How can you hate a guy like that? At least he's not playing sleepover with a 10-year-old. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
I'm out of here. I got a meeting with CAA. I got things to do.
All right, Johnny. Good to see you, man. Take care. Be careful. Oh, well, you know, Bob Woodward. There's a lot of people pissed off at him. One of them is Judy Belushi, John Belushi's ex-wife, who is coming out here, and she's written a book, you know, sort of tearing him an ass. And she's going to be here on Monday to talk about it. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Tim Robbins about the death penalty, I believe, and about the Tukey Williams clemency issue. Also, we got Bruce Cherry, who's going to be three of his last pitches of the week. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here. It's Morning Sedition. My partner Mark Riley is gone for the week on vacation. He'll be back on Monday to bring in the last 10 episodes of Morning Sedition. Look, folks, what's going on out there in the world today? Well, today is World AIDS Day. It's time. It's a day to remind yourself and people you know that AIDS is existing, still exists, and is as deadly as ever. There have been 3 million deaths in the past year of AIDS. There have been 5 million new infections this year. Infection rates are rising in nearly every part of the world. 95% of the total number of people with HIV worldwide live in the developing world. Sub-Saharan Africa is the worst affected region on the planet. The region has only 10% of the world's population, but it is home to 60% of all people with HIV. Here in the United States, approximately 1.2 million people currently live with HIV in America. There are new drugs. There are great new drugs that are keeping people I know alive for over, 15 years. If you can get those drugs, if they are affordable to you, which they should be, and I hope that that some of the awareness goes into, putting money into the right place to get all the people that have the disease or are infected with HIV the drugs they need. Moving on a bit, last night Bush gave a speech to a fixed house at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and he tried to resell the tired stay the course agenda to the American people. The Democrats' reaction from the likes of people like Senator Russ Feingold, one of the few who didn't vote to give the president the right to use force at his discretion, i.e. he voted against the war from the beginning, pointed out the redundancy of Bush's stay the course rhetoric. He also also pointed out the necessary truth that, quote, from Feingold, the lack of plan to redeploy troops feeds the insurgency and hurts our national security, that's for sure. Senator Harry Reid, minority leader, said, quote, simply staying the course is no longer an option. We must change the course, end quote. I saw Joe Biden on TV yesterday. It's too bad that that guy is a whore to the credit card industry because, man, you know, he had the juice. He had the juice, and he seems to be a very smart guy, but I don't think I could ever vote for him for president. Representative what was I going to say? He said that basically there is no pulling out, that if there's going to be a pulling out, there has to be some sort of coalition rebuilt. They have to get the world's help, and I think we've alienated the world sufficiently that they're not going to help us in that way. Representative Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader, said she will back John Murtha's call to quickly start the withdrawal of U.S. troops. So that's good. Now, Samuel Alito, a nominee for the Supreme Court, you know, back in 1985, apparently, if you're curious about what this guy wants to do, he has been the backer of an insidious agenda to dismantle Roe v. Wade from behind it or under it or around it, not take it on face to face, but make it powerless. Back in 1985, when he was with the Reagan administration as an assistant to the Solicitor General, he aided in defending the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act. All right. Some of the act's provisions had been overturned by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and this was a case called the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists versus Thornburg. A memo in reference to the case by Alito was released yesterday. It said, quote, no one seriously believes that the court is about to overrule Roe v. Wade. By taking these cases, i.e. like the case that's going on with the New Hampshire case today and with this College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists versus Thornburg, by taking those kind of cases, Alito says the court may be signaling an inclination to cut back what can be made of this opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade and, in the meantime, of mitigating its effects. This guy has been doing this since 1985, at least, slowly chipping away at abortion legislation to where Roe v. Wade becomes powerless. And so let's be clear. This guy wants to make it impossible, if not illegal, for abortion to be performed safely in this country. So I hope that people who are going to be interviewing him, senators on that committee, or on that panel, the nomination, I hope they take him to task, and I hope that, you know, he doesn't make it onto the Supreme Court because he's dangerous. I don't know if we'll ever get someone who isn't dangerous in this way from this president, but I wonder if we could hold, how many years we could hold it off. I think there's probably statute of limitations on that. Hey, right now, one of our writers, Bruce Cherry, has been trying to get a regular character. Did I mention Tim Robbins is going to be here, Bruce?
Yeah. Sorry, I missed Todd Berry yesterday.
Yeah, Todd Berry was here yesterday, and Rick Overton, and Tim Robbins is going to be in here in a few minutes. One of our writers, Bruce Cherry, who is here, has been trying to get a regular character on the show. His presentations have been characterized by two things, searing humor and trenchant political commentary.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say, people? His use of nuance to highlight the psychological motivations of his myriad characters reminds one of Chekhov. And I mean the playwright, not the guy on Star Trek.
Please. Boom.
It's very good. Isn't it funny how I just read whatever you write and you just watch it come out of my mouth?
I should make it more laudatory for myself.
Yeah, more laudatory. Please welcome my dear friend Bruce Cherry for Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that very, very generous introduction.
Yeah, it came from my heart.
Well, this time, as you know, trenchant political commentary, you were kind enough to mention.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what I call deep ecology.
Uh-huh.
As you yourself have said, I am a warrior for planet Earth.
Okay.
In my reading this week, I came across a story about a species of fish, this is true, that communicates with the noise from their farts.
Is this for real?
No, this is actual truth.
Okay.
But flatulent scientists are concerned that the noise from the ship traffic is interfering with the conversations. So I saw this story and I said, hey, there's a golden opportunity.
Yeah, a golden opportunity to incorporate fart sounds.
Mark, I plan to take a route called the high road.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it's not on your map.
The high road. Bruce, you have Kalo stationed with his finger on the fart button sound effect.
Uh-huh. He's going to employ it judiciously and with a modicum of decorum. Isn't that right, Chris?
What? Is it time for the butt trumpet? Should I puff the magic dragon?
No. Okay, just wait till I say.
Hey, Bruce, what kind of fish are these farting fish?
They're herring, Chris.
Really? Because I thought they might be a smelt. Get it? Smelt?
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking that into the gutter before I even got to the introduction. Am I the only one here with any refinement?
Oh, boy.
Okay, the character is Patrick the Flatulent Herring.
Uh-huh.
Can we please go to script, Mark?
Okay, here we go. Folks, we are the stewards of this planet, but how often we fall short in our responsibilities to Mother Nature is vividly illustrated by our next guest. His very way of life is endangered by our reckless traverse of his ocean home. Please welcome Patrick the Flatulent Herring.
Hey, is it time to singe the carpet? Should I do the trouser call?
You idiot! Wait till I signal you! Okay, focus. Go back to the script, Mark.
Oh, my God. All right. Patrick, I understand you have a unique way of communicating.
Yes, you see, in the briny deep, some sounds carry better than others. Come on, man. I want to let the beans out.
You halfwit! You're dragging this bit into the mud.
Yes, time to blow mud.
Oh, you moron. That sound was supposed to be the climax of the whole bit. We're going to build to it. Now it's ruined.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. I'll make it good. How about if I ask the questions?
What makes you think you have the slightest qualification to appear in this bit?
Well, I've always had a sincere concern for the health of oceans. I'm worried about overfishing. And I had a cheese omelet for breakfast. Oh, excuse me.
Look, loser, I spent a lot of time developing this fish character.
Oh, that's right. What's your name again?
You know damn well. My name is...
Whoa, Mr. Fish. Sounds like you got hold of some bad plankton. Let me see that fart button. Do you feel okay, Bruce? Because it sounds like you have hemorrhoids.
What are you doing? I'm the author of this piece.
And I'm the gas master.
Yes, 8.5 on the rectal scale.
We are insane in the mythy.
Look, you clowns. I have something to say. I am an artist. I refuse to be the butt. I won't be made a fool of. This whole bit has devolved into nothing but a cruel mockery of me.
Okay, you're absolutely right, Bruce. But I'll tell you what, though, I think this pitch went very well.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you want to make it a regular bit?
Yes, I do. Why don't we shake on it, buddy? Whoa, don't pull my finger.
Okay, that's it. I am out of here. We probably should tell the folks at home that was scripted, and that, I mean, I want people calling in and thinking that I was truly upset.
Are you kidding? We just made so many kids under 10 happy in the cars driving to school with their parents. I get emails all the time from parents driving to school with their kids who like are excited that they get information from our show and their kid laughs. So that was for you, parents of children driving to school. It's 15 past the hour. Tim Robbins is in the wings. Hang out. Air America.
This is Rob Zombie, and it says here, when I'm watching the sunrise after a long night of waking the dead and toasting nachos in the microwave, I listen to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 20 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. How do you like that? Mark Riley. Mark Riley is on vacation for the week, sitting next to me right now, a friend of the show, supporter of the cause, Academy Award winner, Tim Robbins. Good morning, man.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you. You put your hat back on. We're sporting the same weird just-woke-up do.
It's nice to see you for the last time.
Oh, we've got a couple weeks. I think she's coming in next week.
She is.
Because we promised to perform a live Cardinal Milfington piece for her. That's her big favorite,
excellent,
isn't it?
Excellent.
And, we've got about two and a half weeks, 12 more shows.
I want a Sammy Semstill.
We can do that. We should have come by yesterday. We'll get them both on. Maybe you can come back with Susan next week, and we'll have Jim just, it'll just be, I'll, you know what, I'll leave. You can sit here, you sit here with Jim Earl and have him do all his characters. But, what, you want to talk about movies for a minute?
Sure.
Now, is this, you just did a, is it a children's movie? Because we just did a big fart bit for the kids.
Hysterically, funny.
Yeah. It was, I know you're a little concerned. You know, all the guys were up front. It's like, let's see if...
I was coming in to say how much I was going to miss the show.
Oh, It was great. A bunch of comedy writers sitting out front going, let's see if the Oscar winner can follow the farts.
No, but in all seriousness, yeah. I think Air America is making a big mistake. And I just wanted to come and say I'm a big supporter of the show, and I think you're really very talented. And
thanks, man.
I wish that cooler heads would prevail as far as this decision, because I don't think it's a good one. And I've said so. I'm not saying anything to you that I haven't said to them. So
I appreciate it so much, and I'm going to miss doing this if this all comes to pass. And you know, we are trying to get a show on the air in Los Angeles in the evening. I mean, that seems to be the plan in place, and we'll see if that happens. But I love doing this show. It was so funny when he called me on my cell phone, because I was in Boston with my wife, and I'm checking my messages, and I'm like, who the hell is Al Roberts? Who's Al Roberts? You know? And then I get into her grandmother's house. I'm like, oh, it's Tim Robbins. I got to go call Tim Robbins back. And it was kind of an exciting moment to be talking to Tim Robbins up in Boston at my wife's grandmother's house.
Well, I think
house.
I called you the day that you were off. It was like you were off the air. You were taking a couple days off. And I was like,
simmering
they,
down.
They kicked you out already?
Is he gone? Did they just push him off the air? Is that
the
how it
birds,
happened?
The coup.
Yeah. It's all upsetting. But the bottom line is,
I think everyone's got the best intentions of Air America at heart.
Yeah,
I just think they're making a big mistake.
So, well, thanks, man. Yeah. Well, let's see. If I do have a show in L.A., you will come out there and be on my show in L.A., yes?
I will.
Every day?
Yeah, every single day. You can call me for like 3 minutes every day.
Every day. Tim, are you up?
Yeah, hey, what do you want?
Exactly.
I'm at the bar.
Oh, yeah.
It's a night show, right?
Hey, it is a night show, okay, so you will be at the bar. So what now, but is it true that you're doing an opera?
No.
In Los Angeles?
No, you see, you know, that's...
What? Well, is that bad information?
Yeah, it's stupid. You know, I was talking about it, and then I said 2 months ago I was not going to do it, and then they did a press release saying I was going to do
it. So there's a phony press release about a Tim Robbins opera
it's
about that?
Those folks in the opera world, they're ruthless.
I've heard that. The opera conspiracy. Anything to get people to care.
Hey, well, maybe if we put out a press release, he'll do it.
Tim Robbins is doing an opera.
Oh, you pulled out of an opera? Scared?
Yeah.
What kind Scared of doing an opera?
What kind of culture hater are you pulling out of an opera?
No, I made it very clear to them 2 months ago that I was.
Where'd they get the big idea?
I don't know. I think it was someone's agent said.
Just came in.
Someone's agent said, "Hey, we're doing this with Tim Robbins," and they hadn't been told by the opera company that I wasn't doing it.
But so. You did do a movie for kids. That's
I
real.
Did do a movie for kids.
What
called
movie?
Zathura.
And it's not animated.
It's in the movie theaters. It's a great combination of computer generated. What do you call it? Animation.
Animation. Yeah, pixel vision. I don't know what that. I don't know what.
And
it's called, yeah.
And the old style, old school kind of animation.
Actually, old guys sitting there drawing the characters.
No, more live action special effects.
Oh, really? Like claymation?
No.
Like Gumby?
Davy and Goliath. Yeah,
I don't know, Davy. Tim Robbins might know. I hear Tim Robbins is doing an opera. I hear he's the Antichrist.
I've heard that, too. What?
No, it's, you know, when you have actual effects happening on the camera.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know all that technical stuff. The blue screen thing.
And stuff.
So, in Tenacious D, you're going to be in their movie.
I am playing an incarnation of Beagle in that.
How does that look?
Man, I had good teeth.
Yeah?
I had a great hair, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I got a wig.
Yeah?
Bad teeth.
Yeah, the red skin.
Had a limp.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They really pushed it. They made you do the dance, huh?
I couldn't move very quickly. Let's just put it that way.
So now you've known Jack and Kyle a long time,
A
right?
long time, yes. About 20 years or so. Now, I've known Kyle longer than I've known Jack.
Because I know Jack Black. I did a gig with them. I know Kyle as well. We used to do Comedy Circuit together occasionally. And a lot of people don't realize that Tenacious D was sort of their brainchild, but they met in your actor's workshop. Is
in
that
the
true?
The Actors Gang, yes.
And that's out in L.A.?
The Actors Gang out in Los Angeles and in Culver City.
And did they always have the Tenacious D idea going? Did they just gel?
Well, no. At first, we were touring with a show called Carnage. We went to New York and to Edinburgh and... They were always, you know, playing guitars and stuff, and Jack learned how to play guitar from Kyle. And it slowly evolved over the course of a few years. I remember going out there one one visit, and they were hanging outside the theater, and they were making up a song about O.J. Simpson. It was really, really funny.
Yeah.
That I don't think you've ever heard. But it had something to do with them.
With him being guilty?
O.J., oh, brother. did you kill your wife with a shovel or a knife? It was just, you know.
That's not on the record, I guess.
No, it's not.
Maybe if he comes in. We're trying to get him to come in. I think he's going to be in town next week. Hopefully he'll drop by. So when we're going to take a break here in a minute. And when we come back, I do want to talk about the issue of Tukey Williams' clemency, because the Supreme Court in California turned down the appeals today. So it's really in Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's hands as to decide whether or not the founder of the Crips, who has done incredible work for the community and in stopping, I think, future Crips with working with kids and writing children's books. I think this is a guy that's been rehabilitated. He certainly, has shown his contributions, and I just think it's a heinous waste to allow the state to kill him. And let's talk about that. Do you mind?
No, I don't mind.
Okay, it's 27 past. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley is gone for the week. He'll be back next Monday. He's resting up. And look who just stopped in to say hello to Tim Robbins, who's in the studio with me, Sammy the Stem Cell. How are you, Sammy?
Hi, everybody.
Hey, how you doing? Tim here is a big fan of yours.
Oh, I know. And I just want to say, Mr. Robbins, I think it's a great honor that you come in here and you support the show like you're doing this morning.
Thanks, Sammy.
I've never been more touched, you blue-headed sauce monkey.
That's not very nice, Sammy.
That was kind of hostile.
Hostile. He's a big fan.
Yeah.
Susan Sarandon's a big fan.
Who?
Yeah.
Anyway, look, it's nice of you to dress up, you know?
You know what, Sammy? Get out. Get out. Enough of this. You know, the guy comes, he says, I'd like to meet Sammy. Got nothing but put-downs for him.
Yeah, well, screw you and the horse you rode in on.
Uh-huh. Really, that's really original.
I'm Sacred Life.
Yeah, I know.
Don't forget about that.
Yeah, it's real original.
I wish I had something funnier to say right now, but I just don't do.
You only prepared one, did you?
It's early.
It's okay. Get out.
He's so small.
I know.
He's so small.
I
had pictured a bigger person.
No, he's just...
He's just tiny. He's like the size of a...
little piece of Sacred Life in a petri dish.
Yes, it's just
don't forget it.
It's unbelievable what a powerful voice that little cell can come up with.
Get out, Jim.
All right.
You all right? Good. Okay, good. So look, let's talk about this because the whole topic of the death penalty. Now, like, let me just set people up. Last Friday, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said he was considering granting clemency to Tukey Williams. Yesterday, the California State Supreme Court turned down an appeal for clemency, so it's in the Terminator's hands, and that's not a good nickname to have in this situation. Williams is the guy who started the Crips in 1971 and is accused of killing a convenience store clerk and three people in 1979. He's scheduled to be lethally injected on December 13th. The governor said he would meet December 8th with Williams' lawyer in private. Now, you got people. You signed on to a letter. Archbishop Desmond Tutu signed on. Susan Sarandon. Snoop Dogg. Jamie Foxx. A lot of people are mobilizing and taking action to get this guy clemency. Now, what I want to know is, in these situations, you made a film about this, is that there are people whose core values, because of their sense of vengeance, like let's say the family members of these victims, who will never be able to see that someone like Tukey Williams is probably preventing more death and contributing more to society now than a lot of people, and yet they cannot see past that because they need their vengeance satisfied. How do you address people who think that way in terms of the death penalty?
Well, first of all, we should start with words and the way words are used.
Okay.
Clemency is not necessarily accurate.
No.
It's basically what they're asking for is that Schwarzenegger not kill him.
Kill him, right.
Doesn't mean he's going anywhere.
Right.
He's going to be in jail the rest of his life.
Right.
So clemency sounds like kind of like a free pass.
Right, right.
Do not pass go, just keep going.
Right.
So he'll be in jail. right. for the rest of his life. Now, the other thing is that the issue really is, for me, because I understand the rage of a parent that's lost a loved one. I tried to show that in Dead Man Walking. You have to walk a mile in their shoes and understand that rage. I don't believe that forgiveness is necessarily possible. I think it's possible to reconcile, to come to terms with your future.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, it's a terrible loss, and we have to respect that. The problem I have with the death penalty is that we're asking another person, a person in the state, an employee of the state, to become a murderer, really, and when someone is executed, someone does it.
Yes.
And not only one person, but several people have to do it, and it becomes a very premeditated act. And in that way, I believe we are bringing people who are good, decent people into a situation where they must live for the rest of their lives with the conscience of having killed an individual.
Possibly dozens.
Possibly dozens. The culture of life, to talk about words and talk about you know, how the right uses words, there's an awful lot of conservative Catholics now who understand that if they're going to advocate for a culture of life, that this is part of it, and they must be opposed to the death penalty. There's the terrible hypocrisy of the right wing that is all for saving the sanctity and of a stem cell,
sure,
but not
the murderer's wife.
Right.
Now it's always been interesting.
There's also the idea of the idea of Christianity and the idea of the lessons of Jesus, who did speak with and hung around with criminals,
yeah,
and did understand about forgiveness and about the idea that we all mustn't condemn a person by one act. That one act, the worst day of that person's life, is what's determining his entire existence.
And if they kill this guy, and if they, not unlike Tammy, what was her name, Faye?
Carla Faye Tucker.
Carla Faye Tucker, who Bush executed, or who had killed in Texas, is if this continues to go on, what are jails really for? I mean, the idea that someone like Carla Faye Tucker, who did an amazing service, had a religious conversion, created a church within the prison, did an amazing human service within the prison. This guy, Tukey Williams, writing children's books, raising awareness of parents and kids to not get involved with these gangs. If that is not a great example of what jail is supposed to be, it is a rehabilitative model. If it is not that, and you're not going to, you know, let these people live and continue this work from within jail, you know, what is the point of it?
Well, I think it's politicians on both sides of the aisle have really missed the boat on death penalty. I think if you talk to them privately, at times they'll tell you, some people will tell you, you know, quite frankly, I'm against the death penalty, but I simply can't do that publicly.
Right.
It's a political issue. It's an issue that is such a hot button issue that if someone does go against the lockstep of the rest of what they believe the country wants, they feel that will cost them politically.
Right.
So they sacrifice a few lives for their own political careers. And that's what's I find really contemptible. It kind of goes to the overall mood of things in the country. You know, I always think about Bernie Sanders up in Vermont. He's a particularly progressive person who is consistently voted back into office by a conservative base. I mean, farmers in Vermont are not a bunch of hippies. There's some pretty salt-of-the-earth Republican core value people up there.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they vote for him? Because he's got a spine. He doesn't waver. And they might disagree with him, as you'll see in any country store. I may disagree with the guy, but at least he's got integrity, and I believe in that integrity, and I can agree to disagree with him, We don't see that enough.
Right.
You don't have enough people. Like, well, there was the governor of Illinois.
Yeah.
But only when he was exiting. Only when he realized he was not going to be running for re-election.
A liability,
he said, you know what? This is policy's not working. We're killing innocent people. I'm granting amnesty to all the people.
What do you think about the possibility for a Democratic backbone in the near future about these, like the nomination questions for Alito, or in terms of some of the stuff around the war, in terms of John Murtha? Do you think that we're going to start to see, do you have your eye on anybody that impresses you?
Well, I think it's going to be people like Murtha. It's going to be people like him, because unfortunately, I think that there's such a talk about the word political, that's kind of defined by this kind of one step forward, two steps back kind of approach. Hillary Clinton can kiss my butt, you know. It's just ridiculous statement she's made about the war. First of all, supporting in the first place. Second of all, to kind of equivocate now. I mean, it's that terrible strategy the Democratic Party's had that's wound up in lost elections, lost Senate control, lost congressional control. It's you got to have a backbone. If you want people to vote for you, trust that someone will vote for you, even if they disagree with you on certain issues.
Stand for something. Russ Feingold is another guy who
stand up and mean what you say.
Yeah.
And don't you know, talk about abortion rights as, you know, the way Hillary Clinton's talking about them now. You know, she's trying to get the middle, and she will never get the middle. And by the way, everybody, the working class is still out there, and they're still not voting. And that's the people you really need to appeal to.
Yeah, and they have to do things for those people.
For those people.
Yeah, to get people the health coverage they need, to get people the proper rights when they go up for, the bankruptcy legislation needs to be turned around. These people need representation in courts against corporate criminals. There's so many little things that can really have an effect on working people that are so detached from these moral issues that are done nothing but wedge people against each other.
How about food? How about the idea that we should be able to go into a supermarket and read a label and see when it's genetically modified. You don't even have that right in America.
Or how about effective testing for mad cow disease? How about not having the FDA pimped out by the meat industry?
These are issues that go across Democrat, Republican.
Right.
They have nothing to do with politics. They have to do with health.
Yep.
They have to do with things that will motivate voters. The environment.
Right.
Why didn't Kerry talk about the environment once in the entire campaign?
It makes no sense to me, because a lot of the moral issues, really, when it comes right down to it, most Americans really don't care. It's just that the cultural dialogue has been hijacked by religious fanatics, and a lot of people step in line, or a lot of people just pay lip service to believing these things. But it's not true. The moral issues are just a distraction. The real issues are, you know, food, money, health care, and the environment, and civil rights. I mean, those are the real issues, not whether or not Christmas is being, you know, pushed out of American culture.
That's just another distraction.
Absolutely.
It's just another way to talk about something that really isn't an issue. You know, I did want to mention Dead Man Walking, the movie we did. Sister Helen Prejean asked me to adapt it into a play. And it's last year we were in over 50 schools across the nation. We were offering this play, rights to do this play to theater departments in universities and high schools throughout the country. The only requirement that they need to fulfill is that they have to convince another discipline in the school to take up the death penalty as a course subject in the semester. So, in other words, if the theater department can get the philosophy department or the religion department or the history department to do a course on the death penalty, then we offer the rights to do it.
You could even do it in English. You could do it through literature.
Execution art. You could do it through theater. It's called the Demo Walking School Project. It's in 35 schools so far this year, and if you're interested in that, if you're an administrator in a school or in the theater department out there, please contact the Dead Man Walking Theater Project.
And that's .com, Dead Man Walking Theater Project.
So.
Yeah, will you check that out? we'll check it out, and we'll get the right information out there.
And also, just one more thing.
Yes, Tim?
There's a great movie out, and I have nothing to do with it. I'm not going to benefit anything from this plug, but it's called The Power of Nightmares. And it's going to be playing, in New York at least, at the Cinema Village starting December 9th.
What's great about it?
It is insanely great. It's
about?
Well, it's about the connection between the failed fundamentalism in the early 90s of the Christian right when the election of Clinton and the failed fundamentalism of Osama bin Laden,
okay.
Who was a fledgling at that point and had a fledgling movement. And it shows the connection between that, the connection between these movements faltered,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also goes into the idea of what happened as a result of that and how we wound up today in the situation we're in.
With the
brilliant, brilliant documentary.
And that goes into the government funding the Afghani Arabs against the Russians, that whole bit of business. Now, is this a documentary?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great. And did you see that movie, The Enemy Within?
No.
About the terrorist cell in New York? We had those guys on. That's a genius bit of it's a fictional movie,
uh-huh.
And in terms of capturing the spectrum of Muslim character of Muslim living in this country and what causes jihadism and the difference between jihadists and secular Muslims, a lot of people don't realize there are secular Muslims. It was a brilliantly written movie. You should really check that out. So Tim Robbins, it was great seeing you.
Write to Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
Tell him what you think.
Yeah. DMWplay.org is if you're out of school and you want to get information about doing the Dead Man Walking play and having one of the other disciplines in the school teach a course on the death penalty.
It's been really amazing. It's really led to incredible dialogues with young people. It's not from an agenda point of view that not saying you have to teach a certain kind of course a certain kind of way. It's mm-hmm. just to get people talking about it.
DMWplay.org if you're a professor or you're at school and you want to get involved with that. Great seeing you. Thanks for the support again, Tim.
My pleasure.
See you soon. 49 right. Past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We'll be back with the Cliff Notes.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio. Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week on Morning Sedition Radio Theater, our radio company asks the burning question, where will Mark Maron work when he goes to the City of Angels?
Just in time for Valentine's Day, Paris Hilton is releasing a DVD box set of all her home sex videos with past boyfriends. The 8-DVD set will come in a heart-shaped box and will include extras like audio commentary and a making-of documentary. Wait a minute.
Stop tape. What's wrong, Mark?
I can't do this. Paris Hilton, come on. I just spent 2 years talking about the important issues in this country every day, like the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Boring.
Political corruption.
Boring.
The neocon death cult behind George Bush is trying to wipe out our freedom to choose what movies we see and what TV shows we watch and what kind of people we can marry.
They're really doing that right now in the United States of America?
Yes, they are.
Boring.
That's it. I'm out of here.
Wait, Mark. It sounds like you were really passionate about your last job.
Passionate? I got up at 3:15 in the morning every day for 2 years.
Stop kidding around, Mark. Only an idiot would get up that early. Just let me ask you, how much did Air America appreciate all your hard work and passion? Because this is how much we appreciate it. Andrea, show Mark the check again.
So check out those Paris Hilton DVDs. We'll be back with my exclusive interview of Danny Bonaducci.
That's Mark Maron's future on Morning Sedition Radio Theater. Turn that music off. Turn it off!
All right, there you go. 55 past the hour. I hope that doesn't happen. Tim Robbins is still hanging out. He's trying to figure out how to work his BlackBerry. How's that going?
I can't figure it out. Oh, well. I'm going back to a landline.
Oh, good. Yeah, just get rid of it all.
I'm going back to the landline. What do you call that?
Maybe you could just walkie-talkies. All right, I got to get to the jokes. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. In his speech yesterday, President Bush offered no new strategy or timetable for getting out of Iraq. The president insisted we are adjusting our tactics to meet changing circumstances, an argument undercut by the fact that he has barely even changed the wording of the argument in the past year. A study says that the powerful emotions involved with falling in love are triggered by a specific molecule and don't last more than a year. Scientists say that the molecule responsible for the feeling of passion and love only lasts for a year. Conversely, after 5 years of a relationship, the body will develop the molecules responsible for bitterness, resentment, misery, and contempt, which could last until the relationship ends and for an additional 2 or 3 decades afterwards. The passion molecules are responsible. The passion molecules are possible to replenish, but it usually includes sneaking around, using 2 phone numbers, and paying for a hotel room in cash. Certain shop objects, like certain sharp objects, like scissors, are going to be allowed back on airplanes under new rules to be announced tomorrow. After years of research, Homeland Security has discovered that scissors can only be considered a dangerous weapon in the hands of a Supercuts employee. Hello, Supercuts. All right. That's the wrong sound. Scissors under 4 inches long will be allowed. Officials still stress that under no circumstances were you to ever run with scissors. Wow. Man, I don't even want to do the phrase of the day.
Three, four.
Of the day, just drop it in a conversation. You know what? I'm not going to do it. Are you still playing with that thing? Wake up, sheeple. Tim Robbins can't work his BlackBerry.
Going in the garbage.
Who's on the show tomorrow, Brendan?
Stephen Colbert's here tomorrow.
Oh, Stephen Colbert, you just did his show. Looking forward to that.
Very funny show.
Here we go. Morning Sedition. See you later.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.